Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Today, journalist Trevor Aronson returns to the Peter B. Collins podcast. He appears to be the only dedicated reporter covering the underbelly of prosecutions for so-called domestic terrorism in this country since 9/11. In a four-part blockbuster series at The Intercept, he explores and updates the so-called War on Terror. And it's a real eye-opener. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you who support my work, including Cheryl Fleming, the incredible Faith Peoples, the equally incredible Terry Paris, and the remarkable Dick Attlee. I get in trouble with these adjectives. You got a broken heart. I appreciate their support. You can join them. The details are at peterbcollins.com. Trevor Aronson returns to the Peter B. Collins podcast today on the heels of a powerful package of stories at The Intercept, updating the FBI's war on domestic terrorism. Their scoreboard looks really good until you look at the cases. Our opening music today from 10cc. The song's called Good Morning Judge. He didn't do it. He wasn't there. And I selected that because so many of the cases that the FBI describes as domestic terrorism investigations that often lead to no trial but a plea bargain and long prison sentences, in my view, are empty cases, frame-ups of innocent or at least marginally innocent people. Trevor Aronson has been covering these issues for some time now, and I first talked to him back in 2014 when he released The Terror Factory, a book that remains important. And his latest series at The Intercept, in many respects, updates the excellent coverage that he gave us in the Terror Factory book. Trevor, welcome back.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Give me an idea of how long it took you to prepare this four-story package updating us on domestic terrorism prosecutions.
You know, all in, it was close to a year. I worked with a research editor at the Intercept named Margot Williams for the vast majority of this, and you know, we spent a lot of that time going through public records and court records and just trying to build as comprehensive of a database of terrorism prosecutions as we could. But, you know, start to finish, from building the database to writing the stories, we were clocking in at close to a year.
And what strikes me is you kind of have this franchise to yourself. And, you know, I cover most of the stories that you publish on this range of issues. But we don't see many other investigative reporters or media outlets like 60 Minutes really taking up this important set of issues and questions.
You know, I guess I have a couple thoughts on that. I mean, one is, you know, just personally, I've always been one of these reporters that feels that, you know, when you do a story, you kind of think of it like, you know, a nail in the wall. You know, to drive it totally into the wall, you can't just hit that nail one time. You've got to hit it over and over and over and over again. And I think, you know, journalism that has impact and affects change is the type that is sustained and that you write about for a prolonged period of time in as sophisticated a way as possible. And, you know, I think that's been my goal with coverage of terrorism prosecutions, you know, now that I've been doing it for, you know, 6 or 7 years. You know, I never started this expecting to be here 6, 7 years later doing the same thing, but I think it's worth it. And, you know, at the same time, what makes this difficult for other media to do as kind of a one-off story is that, you know, for one, this is pretty complicated stuff. You know, the criminal statute on the federal level is complicated. The defendants that they haul into court, even the ones who I would argue, you know, probably don't deserve terrorism prosecutions, are not always the friendliest, most sympathetic people. And there's a hell of a lot of gray in covering these issues. And so I think it's one of these things that in general the media has shied away from and to some degree. But that said, I mean, there has been some good coverage. You know, even recently, 60 Minutes did a piece on the you know, Dram Mohammad shooting and how the FBI had an undercover there. And so now we're seeing some calls for congressional hearings. I mean, we're getting some traction, but, you know, I've been on this a long time and, you know, you're not getting quite the traction that you would expect given how, you know, important these issues are. And
well, when you were at Al Jazeera America, you were doing video reports on these themes. And I really appreciated that. And it separated Al Jazeera from its competitors, I thought.
For sure. I mean, you know, Al Jazeera at the time was looking to do investigative reporting on topics that weren't otherwise being covered in a sustained way by other media. And also were looking to do it in, you know, a long form way. You know, I mean, the documentary I worked on with Al Jazeera was an hour. You know, there aren't many, you know, television networks willing to devote the airtime and the expense necessary to do that type of reporting.
Oh, I don't know if they launch into an in-depth investigation of the Kardashians, they'll apply all kinds of resources, give them, you know, helicopters.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I mean, in that joking way, I mean, you are kind of pointing to a truth in the sense that, I mean, part of the problem with media in many ways, and I don't mean this as a polemic, like here's the problem with media, but you know, I mean, just one of the things that you do see that I think is problematic is, you know, we have, you know, media organizations that are catering to what they think people want, like the lighter stuff, you know, an in-depth look at the Kardashians versus, you know, in the old gatekeeper models of journalism, you know, kind of pre-internet, you know, there was this feeling like you need to cover stories that the viewer or the reader might not necessarily want, but you think they need to know. And I think there's a little bit less of that going on. I mean, certainly you can point to organizations like The Intercept and ProPublica, The New York Times, and a host of others that still do that. But, you know, on the whole, you know, particularly with kind of the mass media of cable news, you know, that's not what we're really seeing any longer.
So I'll be providing a link to your package of stories at The Intercept in the show file for today's podcast, and I encourage listeners to spend some time there. And when you get to the opening page, it would be the cover story, if you will, there's an excellent summary of where we are since 9/11. And let me thumbnail it for you. There have been 796 terrorism defendants prosecuted by the Department of Justice. Most of them have been charged with material support for terrorism and criminal conspiracy. These are vague, nonviolent offenses that give prosecutors wide latitude for scoring quick convictions and plea bargains. Of the almost 800, 523 pleaded guilty. And Trevor, as you know, in those cases, we have no opportunity to examine the real record, to look at the role of paid FBI informants who may have set up the crime, framed the suspect, and those become slam dunk closed cases that just score, you know, an A plus on the proverbial FBI scoreboard. And they often overcharge these defendants and scare the shit out of them and their lawyers so that they will take a plea deal because they're facing, in some cases, life in prison.
Absolutely. You know, that's, you know, the tried and true tactic of the federal government is to try to overwhelm defendants with charges that can't carry mandatory minimum sentences of 30 years or more. And I think most defendants these days look at the scoreboard and they see that the Department of Justice has a near perfect record of conviction in cases like this. And they think, well, I can, you know, take a plea and serve 12 years, or I can go to trial and face 30 years or more, and the majority of defendants in positions where they are using public defenders decide to plead guilty. And of course, you're right. I mean, one of the difficulties that this phenomenon creates for researchers like me is that we only get the tip of the iceberg. You know, we only get to know the full extent of the FBI's behavior in these cases for the ones that go to trial, with a few exceptions when defendants who've pleaded guilty have information that, you know, comes to light that provides a window into the investigation.
And for example, you know, I'm extremely interested in the case of Abdul Muttalib, the so-called underwear bomber, who we're told was dispatched by Anwar al-Awlaki to fly into Detroit. I guess he chose Detroit, not Awlaki. I want to be clear about that. But to fly into the United States and detonate this in U.S. airspace. And because he cooperated and then pled guilty, we can only hear his voice through FBI leaks. And so we don't know the full story. And I'm still highly uncomfortable that we executed Awlaki by a drone strike in Yemen without any due process and without providing public evidence of his alleged responsibility.
Right. It's absolutely extraordinary. I mean, I think, you know, people, and rightfully so, are concerned about Donald Trump and the Trump administration and abuse of presidential powers. And those are valid concerns. But I think, you know, we're quick to not remember the abuses of presidential powers that we saw under President Obama, you know, including the extrajudicial killing of Anwar al-Awlaki based on evidence that we haven't fully seen. You know, and what makes it difficult to get information on someone like Abdul Muttalib's case, for example, is that by pleading guilty, the discovery doesn't become available. He's a young man. The only way, short of leaks from the government that in large part the government wants out, we are able to get a full kind of catalog of evidence in his case will be, you know, when he passes away and we can file FOIA requests. And that will be, what, 50 years from now? And so, you know, it creates a very difficult process for reporters like us to kind of go in and try to find the full truth of what happened in a case like his.
Indeed. So going back here to the tally of the nearly 800 defendants prosecuted in U.S. courts, 175 were found guilty at trial. Only two have been acquitted, and three saw charges dropped or dismissed. So five cases out of nearly 800 brought led to a dismissal or an acquittal. Now, that is a very impressive record, you know, on the part of the FBI and Justice Department prosecutors. But then we scratch below the surface, and that's what you have done so effectively, Trevor. You go on to tell us that 345 people charged with terrorism-related offenses are in custody right now, including 58 who are awaiting trial. And we'll get to more detail in a bit, but you note that 415 terrorism defendants have already been released from custody, often with no provision for supervision or ongoing surveillance, suggesting, and this is something I underline here, that the government does not regard them as imminent threats to the homeland. Now, this doesn't square with the pre-trial publicity and the way that when these cases break, the media pounces and declares that our, you know, federal authorities have protected us from another devastating terrorism attack. But what percentage of these cases, you know, really posed real threats where there was an imminent prospect of some sort of violent behavior, Trevor?
I mean, you can count on, you know, your two hands the number of cases where you could fairly say that this person, you know, presented an imminent threat, you know, had the capacity, had the weapons, and had a plan. You know, an example would be Najibullah Zazi, who, you know, was in Denver making backpack bombs and had largely completed those backpack bombs and was planning to drive them across the country to New York and plant them on the subway. You know, that's an example. But there are not many. I mean, we're talking about a dozen cases where you can point to that of the nearly 800 terrorism defendants who have been charged since 9/11. You know, and I think that's really what we were trying to draw contrast with in this series. I mean, the genesis of this was that Margo and I started looking at release dates for people in our database and realized, you know, there's a hell of a lot of people who've been released or are about to be released. And, you know, this idea that people can go to prison for terrorism charges for 6-7 years and get released and move back to their home communities without any kind of supervision, it just didn't square at all with the kind of national security theater that you see upon the arrest, that they say, you know, were it not for the FBI, this person was dangerous and we stopped them and now they're going to jail. You know, if they were that dangerous, you know, 6-7 years later, aren't they as dangerous, if not more dangerous than before? You know, but the BOP and the Department of Justice don't see it that way if they're, you know, releasing 415 people who've been charged with terrorism and, you know, are in no way under any kind of supervised release.
Trevor, don't take me literally on this next question. It is tongue-in-cheek. But has the FBI hired producers who used to work for NBC on To Catch a Predator to stage the takedowns of these schlubs, in most cases, that they set up for these so-called terrorism offenses?
You know, it's funny. Like, it's funny you would mention that, because I've often had conversations with friends and colleagues where I mentioned, you know, that the only person kind of more difficult to defend than people in these terrorism cases are people accused of child molestation. You know, and so certainly, you know, this works in the government's favor, just as To Catch a Predator worked in NBC's favor, right? Like, no one wants to defend the deplorable guy who wanted to get with an underage girl any more than they want to defend the person who said some really stupid things and seemed to be interested in some sort of attack on innocent people. It's, you know, no one wants to be the guy who goes like, hey, maybe their constitutional rights were a little violated there, or maybe that was entrapment, or maybe that was unethical behavior, you know. And so that's what makes kind of covering and defending these defendants, you know, difficult in that way. But certainly the numbers suggest that, you know, of these 800 people that have been charged with terrorism, you know, the vast majority were not dangerous, because if they were very dangerous, or if they were dangerous at all, they certainly would be spending longer periods in jail and in prison, excuse me, or would be under a program to make sure that they're not going to go to the local Home Depot and buy a bunch of chemicals to make bombs to, you know, to plant in their local city. I mean, that's kind of the absurdity of the situation right now.
And as we'll detail in a bit, some of these people get recycled by, you know, trading information and agreeing to go undercover or infiltrate the next round of alleged domestic terrorism suspects. Trevor, before we move on from the cover page here, I want to draw attention to the graph here that is titled Purported Affiliation in All Cases. And you go all the way back pre-9/11, and you show that, you know, before 9/11, we had no idea who we were talking about, and many of these cases were not related or connected in any substantive way. But starting with 9/11, Al-Qaeda became the focal point, and we see a spike there in 2002 and again around 2007. And then Al-Shabaab enters the picture, and we saw a number of cases, including the San Diego prosecution of some people who tried to send less than $10,000 to Al-Shabaab. And then the big spike starting in 2014, the blue line there that represents the Islamic State. And as we see this kind of rotating cast of characters, again, getting cynical about it, if we treat this as kind of a television serial, you know, the bad guys kind of change, but the rest of the system doesn't. It just finds new people to pump through this prosecution machinery.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can, you know, when I've talked to FBI agents in years past and before the rise of ISIS or even the creation of ISIS, I remember FBI agents telling me, you know, our main focus is Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda cases and Al-Qaeda lone wolves, people inspired by, you know, the magazine Inspire, the Al-Qaeda magazine, or by other Al-Qaeda propaganda. But hey, look, we're really also concerned about, you know, Shabaab and, you know, kind of the growing influence that it's having, particularly in the Somali community in Minnesota. And so you can see, like, from this timeline we've created, that, you know, you can see the kind of ongoing interest in Al-Qaeda cases post 9/11, the increasing interest in Shabaab at the end of the of the 2000s. And then I think what's most interesting is just the full-scale consolidation of all of those groups into ISIS, which reflects both the kind of landscape for jihadis and wannabe jihadis, but also the focus of the FBI. I mean, you know, there are cases now where people have been prosecuted for, you know, material support or wanting to get involved in ISIS. And most of these prosecutions have to do with activity online, people communicating with would-be ISIS recruits. And, you know, one thing that they'll say is that, you know, most of these guys online pretending to be ISIS guys are FBI. And it's true based on the prosecutions. I mean, if you, you know, most of these prosecutions involve somebody who really isn't in contact with anybody from ISIS, but, you know, there's an FBI agent, you know, in some office in Virginia pretending to be related to ISIS, and they then pull off a sting operation from there.
His name is Billy Bob al-Baghdadi.
That's right. And so I think that is what's interesting. You know, I mean, there's a question of like how many of these ISIS cases would have been like real ISIS cases. You know, how many of the people online pretending to be ISIS recruiters are actually FBI? You know, I think that's one of the interesting things. And certainly the vast majority of prosecutions related to ISIS, you know, are people who never, you know, were able to, you know, get out of the United States. They were just people who conspired online to go to Syria or to get involved in some attack with the help and encouragement of FBI agents, you know, again, in some office in Virginia or somewhere else, just behind a Facebook page pretending to be someone they're not.
Trevor, in your first package that you published as part of this four-part series, Trial and Terror at The Intercept, you go in depth on a story that you first covered in your book, Terror Factory, and that's about the Liberty City Seven. These are people from the Miami area, and I take it because you're from Florida that that was one of the first cases like this that really got your attention.
Yeah, so there's a couple of reasons why I've just continued to track this case. I mean, one is that it really was the case that set me down this road. I remember going to the press conference in Miami when it was first announced in 2006 and just thinking this is like a hell of a smelly case. And, you know, I followed it through the years, and then I began to realize that, you know, there were a lot more cases like it. And, you know, that's actually what inspired me to, you know, work on the book, was realizing that there was this enormous trend of cases like the Liberty City Seven. But also, I think that the Liberty City Seven in many ways is a great example of the abuses that occurred in these cases. And I think it's kind of in many ways prototypical of post 9/11 terrorism stings. And so in some ways, I've used the Liberty City Seven throughout my work to represent a lot of these cases, but I think in many ways the themes that are there are in many of the other terrorism stings that are out there. But in some ways, the Liberty City Seven is just so comical and so egregious that it's just like a great example to use to kind of tell this larger story. And so I first wrote about them to tell the story of stings and the abuses that have happened in stings. And, you know, now most recently I'm using this case to describe how, you know, these people that the government described, you know, 10 years or less ago are, you know, as dangerous would-be terrorists are just being released, and no one's talking about that and no one's mentioning that. And, you know, to me it's rather extraordinary that 10 years ago, you know, the Department of Justice and the Attorney General would get up before the national press and say, you know, we busted these guys and they were going to declare ground war against the United States and they were dangerous. And then, you know, 10 years later, they're just quietly released to go back to their homes in Miami, and no one says anything about that. I mean, I think that's just really extraordinary and shows the discrepancy between, you know, what the government says when these people are arrested and, you know, what the government does upon their release. And definitely, I think, shows that, you know, these people aren't really that dangerous after all, because if they were dangerous, certainly the government would be doing a lot more to monitor them and certainly would have done more to try to keep them in prison.
Trevor, you described the case, one of the FBI's earliest informant stings, as sloppier than most because much of the Bureau's evidence seemed to support the men's steadfast assertion that they were street hustlers trying to scam a big-talking Middle Easterner out of his money, not terrorists on the make. And I'm reminded of the colorful comment from James Carville, back when Bill Clinton was battling his bimbo problems. And, you know, Carville tried to dismiss the charges that were made by various women as, well, you know, when you drag a $100 bill through a trailer park, you never know what you get. And here the FBI appears to be doing that on a larger scale. And when you consider that, you know, they provided money to rent a warehouse, they got these guys' uniforms, all kinds of, you know, surveillance equipment was deployed. They spent a lot of money on this, and they had to have known what you now know, that these were not people who posed any serious threat. They were planning to blow up the Sears Tower, which has been renamed something else, and they didn't even know where it was. And so, I mean, this is cartoonish. And yet our government spent a lot of resources that might have been better devoted to real crime and real potential terrorists. And instead, they serve up this kind of TV soap opera bullshit.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think when I first heard about this case, when it was announced, and before I even was able to read the criminal affidavit and understand really what they were alleging, I remember – you know, the government announcing that they had this terror cell in Liberty City. And, you know, I was a reporter in Miami. I knew Liberty City well. It's like the last place you would expect some Al-Qaeda cell. And so I just remember being very skeptical from the beginning. And, you know, and then clearly even from the affidavit, it was clear that the government was presenting these guys with an opportunity that, you know, if you knew anything about living in Liberty City, there aren't jobs available. There aren't, you know, ways to, you know, climb the ladder in society. I mean, this is a place where, you know, drugs are sold, where people run street hustles, and that's just the way of life. And, you know, what these guys did was just run a simple street hustle on this guy who came over and is like, hey, I've got $25,000 and I'll get you a car, you know, for the Liberty City Seven guys. I mean, and I think, you know, their story for years now has been consistent and, you know, has had no cracks or no flaws in this. You know, they really just were following the main guy, Narcil Batiste, lead in running this hustle on this guy. And they felt like whatever they needed to say, they'd say, because they were going to get $25,000. And they had reason to think this was real because the government gave them a new warehouse, gave them a minivan, gave them, you know, and this is critical, gave them a refrigerator full of food, right? And like, these are guys that come from homes where they don't have food in their refrigerator. And so that was like a big thing for them. And so they're thinking, well, they got all this stuff, you know, certainly this $25,000 is real. And, you know, to this day, I don't know how many people in the FBI then, you know, realized that this, that these guys thought they were running a scam, or how many of them, you know, really thought that they had, you know, kind of aspirations for terrorism. But, you know, I think, you know, most people who have any sophistication, you know, about neighborhoods like Liberty City would look at the evidence and say, okay, yeah, these guys are just running a scam. But, you know, ultimately they got prosecuted for doing stupid things as part of that scam, but I don't think that makes them terrorists, you know. And, you know, 10 years later, most of them are now out of jail, and Narcil Batiste will be released later this year. And so, you know, if they really were terrorists, perhaps they would have spent a longer time in jail.
And what have you been able to discover about the total amount that the government spent to surveil and prosecute the Liberty City Seven?
So, unfortunately, we've never really, in any case, had a full accounting of the government's expense in pursuing cases like this. But, you know, in cases like Liberty City Seven, or, you know, like the Newburgh Four outside New York City, you know, these are operations where the government spends months, nearly a year, in some cases more than a year, you know, doing 24/7 surveillance, you know, engaging five, six, seven agents at a time, engaging an informant. I mean, we're talking like multi-million-dollar operations. Mm-hmm. To pursue these. Unfortunately, you know, we don't have a full accounting of even, you know, how much the government spends just on stings in the aggregate. You know, the FBI's budget is broken down for terrorism, you know, is broken down. And we know that for counterterrorism, you know, the FBI spends $3 billion, the largest part of its budget. But we don't know of that $3 billion, how much of it is spent on stings like this. Agents I've talked to, you know, and people who know the FBI well, I mean, describe these as, you know, hugely, hugely expensive endeavors. And that would be, you know, stand to reason given the amount of people and resources and time necessary to develop these cases. And so, you know, the implication of that from a bureaucratic standpoint is, you know, what happens in cases where they've spent 9 months on somebody or a group of people, and they've devoted 5, 6, 7 agents for that time, and they can't really get a very good case. Do they just say like, hey, sorry about that, we spent all this money and we're just gonna bag this one? No, I mean, they generally find a way to charge these people. I mean, that's just the nature of bureaucracy. If you worked at an accounting firm and you had a project where you spent 9 months and your boss said, hey, what do you got for me? You can't just be like, hey, sorry, I don't have the project ready, let's just forget it. You know, that just doesn't work in most industries. And unfortunately, that does include law enforcement and the FBI. And I think, you know, that ultimately becomes one of the drivers of these cases and one of the reasons that when cases aren't particularly compelling or the evidence is not very good, we're still seeing, you know, pushes toward prosecution. And that's kind of further emboldens the FBI to do things like that because of this near perfect record of prosecution. You know, you can put forward a shitty case and still expect to get an indictment and likely conviction.
We do know here in the Bay Area that the FBI spent more than $1 million on the Shrimp Boy sting case. That's where they used a Chinatown former gang member and his entourage to investigate corrupt politicians. They did nail a state senator who's currently in federal prison and some of the people around him. But they used some of these kinds of tactics where the agent, the key agent who had performed the sting, was permitted to testify without disclosing his identity. And there were other kind of shortcuts to procedure and constitutional process that were used to win convictions in that case that I just referenced. So let's turn now to part two of your four-part series, Trevor, where you describe what is now a kind of revolving door for these domestic terrorism suspects and convicts. And you identify that 30, at least, have become informants or cooperating witnesses since they were charged. And this creates another cycle of problem. In simple terms, garbage in, garbage out. And so if you take someone who has already been exposed to the sting operations as a subject, and then you empower them to visit that on the next generation of suspects, I find this highly problematic.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big ideas of this package in the series was this disparity between people like the Liberty City Seven, who didn't really know any terrorists or didn't know any terrorists at all, you know, full stop, and didn't have any capacity for terrorism, and they are sentenced for, you know, a decade in prison, and in many cases for defendants like them, it's even more, it's 30 years or more. But for people who have connections to international terrorist groups, who have information that's valuable to the government, who have information that can be used for intelligence or for further criminal prosecutions, they can cut a deal. You know, I mean, they can go to the government and say, okay, I'll work as a cooperating witness or I'll work as an informant. And in many cases, they are not being turned over to the prison at all and are not serving any time in prison. And so you have this enormous and really curious disparity between people who don't know any terrorists, get charged with terrorism, and get sentenced to 30 years or more. And then the truly bad guys who do know terrorists, but because they know terrorists, they're able to cut a deal and, you know, save their own skin and prevent themselves from going to prison. And, you know, I think that's, you know, kind of a hugely compelling narrative about a little bit of the fraud that is the war on terror, in the sense that the more dangerous you are, the more likely you are not going to spend time in prison because you have information to trade. And the less dangerous you are and the least likely that you have any connections to international terrorist groups, the more likely you are to spend time in prison.
Trevor, I've seen this grisly cycle before. California has finally dealt with the issues of long-term incarceration in solitary confinement, the so-called SHUs. And one of the catch-22s is that some of the men who spent years down in the whole, were unable to get out because they didn't have anything to snitch. They'd been there so long that they couldn't tell the authorities, oh, well, I heard that there's a gang operation that's going to hit the cafeteria on Thursday. Well, if you've been isolated for 20 years and you're told you're only going to get out of the hole if you serve up information on gangs in this prison, you know, that is an unachievable standard. And as you point out, the disparity for the people who are purely framed is, you know, they can try to make something up. And we saw a lot of people at Guantanamo try to do that. But this is, you know, a fundamentally unjust imbalance that you've just described.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, to give you some background on how we were able to figure out how many of these people were cooperating, you know, there was a clear pattern in the data. And you know what the government will do is they will get the person who is cooperating to plead guilty to the charges against them, but then they won't sentence them, and it allows the government to basically have this, you know, blade hanging over their head to say, you know, work with us and we'll be lenient in sentencing in the end. And so what we were able to do with the data is look at this and say, okay, well, who's been convicted but has had their sentence pending for more than a year, and that gave us a list of about 50 so people. And then of those, we were able to confirm through reporting that they were cooperating with the government. You know, there are examples where people's sentencing is delayed due to psychological evaluations or medical reasons. And then there are examples where most likely, you know, our number of 30 is low because of that 50, some we couldn't confirm were working with the government, but certainly their pattern in their sentencing data suggested that they may well be. But yeah, I mean, it's an incredible thing that, you know, the more dangerous you are, the more connections you have, the least likely you are to serve prison time. You know, and we had a video that was made for social media as part of this package, and you know, one of the things it did was contrast Narcile Batiste from the Liberty City 7 with Najib Olazazi, the guy who tried to plant backpack bombs on the New York subway. And what's most interesting about that is Eric Holder, the former attorney general, had described him as the most dangerous threat since 9/11 in the United States. And yet here's a guy who hasn't been sentenced, hasn't been turned over to the Bureau of Prisons. And that's because he's cooperating. He's working as a cooperating witness and he's providing information to the FBI. And, you know, if the pattern holds, you know, based on previous cooperators, you know, at some point he'll serve his purpose for the government and they will quietly release him either into the United States or into his home country in Pakistan. And, you know, he'll be free again.
In previous reports, you've talked about some of these opportunists who've earned hundreds of thousands of dollars as paid informants, and we can only guess. You described that Zazi, whose sentence has been pending since he pled guilty in February of 2010, so 7 years, he has been under some witness protection program or in some, you know, kind of a sting operation trying to entrap other people. And we have no idea, right? There's no public information about the whereabouts of Najib Olazazi?
No. You know, their previous informants have been held at military bases in conditions that are much better than your average prison and then have been under FBI custody. But we don't know where Najib Olazazi is. I mean, this is not something the Department of Justice or the FBI cares to comment on at all. You know, based on what we do know from court records, he is cooperating. He is working with the Department of Justice and the FBI. But where he is on any given day is really anybody's guess. And, you know, I think that in some ways should be a concerning thing for Americans, right? Like, here's a guy who, as Eric Holder said, was the most dangerous threat since 9/11, pleads guilty, and then just disappears, you know, disappears into the kind of the dark hole of our federal government. And we don't quite know what he's doing and what information he's providing or for how long he'll be doing that.
You also go into some detail on Ernest James Ujamaa, who you describe as perhaps the most prolific cooperating witness in the war on terror. And he is now living right across the bay from me in Berkeley, getting $2,000 a month from the federal government. Tell us a little more about the weird exchanges of emails that you've had with Ernest Ujamaa.
Yeah, so Ernest and I started to get in touch about a year ago, actually, about the time I started this project. And You know, he was interested in telling his story, and we went back and forth for months. You know, ultimately, you know, it was clear to me that Ujamaa wanted money for his story, and that's just not something I do. And we did agree to meet, and it was clear after, you know, a meeting that we had and agreed to be off the record that he just refused to accept this idea that someone would write his story in a way that he couldn't control. And I think a big part of that, and I read about this in the story, is that Ujamaa was an African American who converted to Islam later in life, and he, you know, testified under oath that, you know, he had grown up under the Black Panthers, and there was a kind of an activism about him and a feeling of wanting to be an activist related to the unfairness in the criminal justice system, particularly as it related to other Black Americans. And so he sees himself in this weird kind of exceptionalism. And by that, I mean, you know, he sees himself as being a victim of this overzealous prosecution in the war on terror, but at the same time, as a star witness for the government, and kind of simultaneously feeling uneasy with the idea that he is a snitch. And, you know, he since responded to my story, and in the comments of the story, you can see a number of very long comments where he takes issue with the story, you know, alleging all sorts of factual errors, but not pointing out any one specifically. Mm-hmm. And you know, Ujamaa in many ways is kind of indicative of what we see. I mean, here's a guy who was connected to Abu Hamza al-Masri, the radical cleric of the North London mosque, who helped funnel fighters into Afghanistan for Al Qaeda, and Ujamaa himself admitted to bringing cash, British pounds, from the UK to Afghanistan and delivering them directly to Al Qaeda associates or Taliban associates. And so here's a guy who had plenty of connections. You know, maybe he wasn't involved in attacks himself. Perhaps, you know, and I think this is true, he would not have gotten involved in any attacks himself. But, you know,
Trevor, let me just jump in here, because what you describe, working as a courier and carrying money, that actually fits the definition of material support. Often that phrase is used just as a catch-all. And in this case, you know, it does appear that he was guilty of material support of actual terrorist groups.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, to Ujamaa's credit, what Ujamaa would say, and I think this is to a certain extent splitting hairs, is that he didn't know the money was going to Al-Qaeda. He thought it was going to the Taliban. And at that time, the Taliban was the government of Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, I mean, you see prosecutions of material support, and material support is such a broad crime that, you know, people are charged with material support even though they'd have no connections to terrorists at all. They, you know, will talk to somebody, an undercover FBI agent, for example, who they think is an ISIS recruiter, and they'll help that person by providing them with a bomb component or giving them money or, you know, pledging themselves to go fight in Syria, and they get charged with material support even though they weren't in contact with any real terrorists. And here's Ujamaa going into Afghanistan pre-9/11, delivering money to people associated with Al-Qaeda and Pakistan. And so the government had a, you know, enormously strong case against him. And the reason he didn't spend the, you know, 30 years in prison or the life imprisonment that Abu Hamza is spending is because he cut a deal. I mean,
mm-hmm.
He basically became a snitch and a cooperating witness. And he testified in two cases, sending, you know, two people to prison. And a third one, had he not pleaded guilty, Ujamaa would have testified in that trial.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think his is an interesting example of someone who, you know, did have connections and, you know, suddenly goes back and starts living in Berkeley, California again, and no one says anything. You know, you could be having coffee one day, Peter, and, you know, you'd be there and you would never know, right? It's a fairly interesting phenomenon I think we have in the post-9/11 era.
And just a footnote, I'm aware of Judge Catherine Forrest, who sentenced Ujamaa only to time served, and she presided over a fascinating trial that challenged Obama's National Defense Authorization Act with that open-ended detention clause you might recall from 2011. And I had a high regard for her. This may change that a little bit. Now let's go to part three, where you describe some of the situations where people, you know, I'm looking at the case here of Alexander Ciccolo, And his parents contacted the FBI because they were concerned about him. And they basically, you know, turned him into a subject of one of these sting operations. Tell us a little more about this case.
Yeah, so Alexander Ciccolo, was for lack of a better term, was from a broken home. He divided his time between his father, who was a Boston police officer, and his mother, who was, you know, something of a hippie, if you will. And his father, Robert Ciccolo, was one of the first responders to the Boston Marathon bombings. And his mother described to me that there was a kind of a fraught relationship between Alexander Ciccolo and his father, Robert. And what we see in this is Alexander being interested in getting involved in ISIS, and in fact, even at one point, like talking about pressure cooker bombs. You know, and I thought, you know, one of the things, just from an armchair psychology standpoint, is this feeling that, obviously there were some father issues going on, right? Like, dad is a first responder to the Boston Marathon bombings, and here's the son talking about getting involved in ISIS and buying a pressure cooker bomb. And so, you know, Robert, you know, being a responsible parent, became really concerned about his son and called up the FBI. And, he told the FBI that his son had a history of mental illness, told the FBI that he was interested in ISIS and that he was really concerned about him. And so, you know, this is a situation where the FBI maybe could have shown up and surprised Alexander and done the whole scared straight routine, or kept an eye on him. But instead, they launched into a full-blown investigation where they used an informant and undercovers and pushed him toward getting involved in an attack on a university. Of course, Alexander didn't have any weapons. I mean, he had some like half-baked ideas for making Molotov cocktails. He had a machete, but, you know, nothing that's going to do widespread damage. And, you know, in the sting, they provided Alexander with the weapons he needed. And then as soon as he purchased the weapons, they arrested him and charged him with material support for ISIS. And what's interesting about his case is that there has been a whole slew of ISIS-related cases that involve people who have, you know, questions about their mental faculties or, you know, have absolutely no assets. I mean, don't have two nickels to rub together, and the FBI provides them with the money or the weapons needed to get involved in an attack. And you know, these tactics aren't new, right? I mean, I think I've been on your show before talking about the exact same tactics related to Al-Qaeda.
Yes, you have.
Related stings. But what we've seen is just the same type of tactics being used, but now, you know, using ISIS as the new designation, using ISIS as the new reason to be concerned. And from the, you know, we talked earlier in the show about the data that we had in the graphic showing this enormous rise in ISIS. I mean, the reason that we wanted to do this as part three of the series was to put a story to describe this enormous bubble of ISIS related stings starting in, I think, 2013. And so now basically that's taken over the FBI's counterterrorism section and stings. I mean, if there's a sting today, it's 99% chance it's going to involve a supposed ISIS defendant. But the vast majority of these cases do not involve people who are actually in touch with ISIS. They are people who are online searching about ISIS, interested in ISIS, and instead of encountering a real ISIS affiliate or agent, they find an undercover FBI informant or agent posing as an ISIS affiliate, and then that person leads them along in a sting that ultimately results in a material support charge.
And Trevor, a colleague who I've been talking to for a number of years now, investigative reporter Bo Hodai, has just published at The Progressive a report on prosecutions in Arizona under a state anti-terrorism law with looser standards than federal law. And one of the first cases he cites is a teenager who was developmentally disabled to the point where he couldn't attend school. And they started grooming him at the age of 14. And after he turned 18 is when they popped him, and he's now doing an 8-year stretch in state prison in Arizona. I'm going to interview Bo Hodai in the next few days, so my listeners will get the details on that story. But this is not an isolated example, and you suggest here that some 63 men and women have been arrested in stings targeting sympathizers. And these are people who may have identified with or communicated with others, maybe cheered on some sort of a jihadi incident or episode. But these are not people who really committed much more than a thought crime or a speech crime in most cases. And as you say, many of them have issues of addiction or psychiatric infirmities.
Exactly. I mean, many of these cases involving the stings are, you know, people who do have psychological issues. You know, in fact, two of the cases that I mentioned in the story involved homeless people who had psychological issues and had absolutely no money. I think it's also worth noting, too, that in addition to the sting cases, there are prosecutions for people providing material support in ways that would, you know, I think surprise most people. You know, one example is that there was a case where an Albanian man had working with ISIS hacked into a commercial database. I can't remember the exact company. It was a company's database of people who purchased things online. And what they did was isolate all of the customer data for people who had government email addresses as the when they purchased it. And so then they isolated that data and they spread it online. And this included, you know, FBI agents and military officers and their, you know, their personal addresses. And so ISIS worked hard to spread that online through Twitter and was basically telling people, hey, here's a bunch of, you know, addresses of government officials. If you want to, you know, do violence, here's where you should go. And there were a couple of people who retweeted that. And in fact, one person has been charged and convicted on material support simply for retweeting that. Or some, you know, another case involves someone who was just providing information online about how to use Bitcoin to avoid currency transactions if you wanted to go to Syria and fight with ISIS. And so there's also a rash of prosecutions related to people who weren't involved in violence and weren't involved in fighting, but were just helping to spread ISIS propaganda through Twitter or other social media platforms.
And Trevor, if you know, is there a specific statute that bars me from joining the Islamic State? Is there a federal law that says that an American citizen is in violation if you go to Syria and join one of those groups?
So what they would do is charge you under material support. I mean, that would be the violation that they would say. And, you know, material support can be so broad that, you know, if you went to – let's say you went to Syria and you're a tourist and you don't really want to join ISIS, but you – stop by and you say hello to some ISIS people and, you know, they're busy. And so you decide, okay, well, I'll fry some eggs for them. Frying those eggs would be material support, right? Like the you can do the simplest task seen as being supportive of the terrorist group and you can be charged with material support.
Did we prosecute any Americans who went to fight in the Spanish Civil War against Franco?
Not that I'm aware. Yeah, that's my area of expertise.
I mean, again, I don't support that. I'm not endorsing it. I'm just saying that I'm not aware of an actual legal barrier. If somebody, you know, what if somebody wants to join one of the groups that's fighting against ISIS? Is that material support? Is that in violation of our effort to take down the Assad government? I don't really know.
So yeah, there was a case recently. It was a young man in Arizona who unfortunately committed suicide. But he was originally charged with, I believe they alleged that he was with Nusra Front, and he was fighting in Syria. But it turned out he was with one of the rebel groups that was against the government and had not been designated as a terrorist organization by the State Department. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, they did have to drop the charges against him. Mm. But that's a rare case, right? And then, you know, kind of building on your point, I mean, there are, you know, the weekend warrior Jewish Americans who go and fight with the IDF all the time, right? And none of them are charged with anything. And in fact, that's seen as something that most Americans view as patriotic and are supportive of.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think, you know, when you talk to people who are interested in supporting the anti-Assad factions that are not related to Al-Qaeda or ISIS, I mean, there's a feeling that there is that double standard, that they can't support them. But, you know, here you have people, you know, doing, you know, weekend warrior stuff with the IDF, and that's okay.
And finally, Trevor, your fourth installment is an elegant refutation of claims that we are at risk from alleged terrorists who would infiltrate with refugees coming from Syria and other war zones where the U.S. was involved in starting the conflict. And you show pretty clearly that the data that was collected by Jeff Sessions and Ted Cruz when Sessions was still in the Senate last year was carefully crafted to create a certain perception. But when you objectively analyze the data, that perception tends to fizzle out. Explain, please.
Sure. So this set of data was one that Margo Williams and I, in building our database, used as a source data for cases. You know, we wanted to find as many cases as possible that the DOJ had listed as terrorism related. And so what Sessions and Cruz did when Obama was still president was ask the Obama administration to give them a list of people charged with terrorism and the nation that they were from. And the Obama administration would not provide that. And so what the Obama administration provided instead was just a list of people charged with international terrorism. And so Sessions assigned his subcommittee staff to research the country of origin for everyone on that list. And they weren't able to find everyone, but they were able to find, I think of the ones that they found, 375 were born outside of the United States. And so to Sessions and Cruz, this meant, okay, well, look, you know, the majority of people on this list are from another country. And so that must mean that terrorism is, a foreign threat. And this is why we need to limit immigration of Muslim countries. But, you know, the data really didn't show that at all. And in fact, I would argue, if anything, the data is ambiguous about what country of origin means as it relates to the threat that someone poses. I mean, you know, the most striking thing to me in the data was that, you know, and to make clear, this is not data that I came up with. This is data that Sessions' own subcommittee, you know, came up with in their research. I mean, the single largest group of people who commit crimes that are charged as international terrorism in the United States are actually from the United States. I mean, that's the single largest group, right?
Yeah.
And so this idea that it's a foreign threat, like, yes, they are fewer than the majority, but if you group everybody by country, you know, the United States has 73 defendants. That's far more than anyone else. And then, you know, the countries on the ban list, while they all are represented on the list, you know, there are some striking problems, right? Like the Pakistan,
like,
for example,
like,
has...
Let me interject here. From Syria, only 7. Egypt, 17. Yemen, 20. Iraq, 19. So these pale in comparison to homegrown individuals, and yet we're told to, you know, fear the other people from these designated countries in Trump's executive order.
Right. And the data doesn't support the countries that he's highlighted at all. Right. And, you know, the U.S. government and specifically the Trump administration's argument for why their Muslim ban isn't a quote unquote Muslim ban, it isn't, discriminating against a religious minority, is that they are saying, oh, well, these are the dangerous companies, or excuse me, dangerous countries, according to what our data shows. And clearly the data doesn't show that. I mean, as I note in the story, you know, there are as many terrorism defendants from Colombia as there are from Yemen, but certainly no one's talking about, you know, banning immigration from Catholic majority countries. And so in some ways, I think this data just kind of shows the absurdity of the travel ban and makes very clear that even according to the government's own data, you know, there isn't a justification for banning these countries other than, you know, banning them specifically because of prejudices related to that they're Muslim majority countries.
Well, Trevor, as we wrap up, I have one final set of questions for you, and it relates to the way certain cases are highlighted and used as touchstones to scare people about the threat of terrorism here in the United States. And so, for example, I remain concerned that we don't know the full story about the San Bernardino events, and in particular, exactly how that couple was radicalized, so to speak. And one of the things that really bugs me still is that one of the critical bits of evidence, and I'm air quoting that, was the allegation that the woman, I think her name was Malik, posted on Facebook some pledge of allegiance to al-Baghdadi during the shooting spree that day in December a year and a half ago. And we have never seen anything that documents that. It's never been proven that it was actually posted. And yet it's one of those things that was used to kind of clinch the meme that you know, these were virulent terrorists, and you know, I'm not in any way understating what they did. What I'm concerned about is the way the case was managed and absorbed by the media.
Yeah, I mean, I think that aspect of the case really took over the narrative, right? I mean, I think, you know, you could argue with a case like that, that this is a workplace shooting incident, right? Like, he basically attacked his coworkers mm-hmm. with whom he didn't get along. And, you know, did his wife post that about ISIS? I don't know. And if she did post it, you know, was it because she truly believed this or because it was kind of an opportunity to get more attention on the case? I mean, it's possible as well. I mean, I think there's a fairly lucid argument to make that, you know, the Orlando shooter, Omar Mateen, when he called 911 and cites ISIS, was just either trying to draw a greater amount of attention to his case or, you know, cover up for you know, the possibility that, you know, what he was doing was being a self-loathing closeted gay man who is, you know, taking out violence on other gay men, right?
And his prior contact with the FBI over workplace disputes at the Port St. Lucie courthouse, where Mateen was a hired private security guard and interacted with the deputy sheriffs, who I'll just lump together as deplorable rednecks. But in exchanges with them, he told the FBI that he made up shit to try to keep them from hazing him. And this, you know, is now treated as fact. And this is the problem I have, is that in these high profile cases, we get wall to wall coverage from the video media, but very shallow examination of the evidence and the backstory. And this applies to the Boston bombing case, in my view, as well.
I mean, I think what, you know, I think one of the reasons for this is that, you know, in truth, the reasons that people commit heinous acts of violence or commit ideologically based acts of terrorism are very complicated, right? And they're not always the same from person to person. But from a government standpoint and from a way that the media generally covers these cases, there's this idea of kind of the radicalization theory, right? Like abracadabra, you looked at some propaganda online and then you become, you know, a terrorist who's pledged allegiance to al-Baghdadi. You know, and I think that's just it overly simplifies things and certainly makes it easy for cable news to describe reasons why people do horrible things like this. But, you know, really then as a result glosses over the fact that this is really complicated stuff. And, you know, the reasons that the San Bernardino couple did what they did and the reasons that Omar Mateen did what he did, you know, might not necessarily be rooted entirely in ISIS or wanting to get involved in ISIS, but
these become critical, Trevor, when we see them used to force backdoors in iPhones, to demand greater surveillance, and so that's why I care. And I know some people think I'm kind of obsessive or that, you know, I'm a little out of the mainstream by continuing to raise these questions. But when I see them used as the basis for unconstitutional encroachments, that's why I consider them to be, you know, worth talking about and reexamining.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think the government has used this perception that you know the ISIS threat is everywhere and could happen anywhere to justify, you know, policies with security and with surveillance that we should all be very cognizant of. And so I think that's a worthwhile skepticism to have. You know, the trouble is that very few people want to have this conversation. And I think it's easy for a lot of people to think, oh, well, you know, the reason he did this is he just got swept up in this ideological, you know, this poisonous ideology that is ISIS, rather than kind of trying to come to terms with the reasons that people actually do commit acts of violence. And maybe even considering at times, whether it's Omar Mateen or the San Bernardino couple, that, you know, if they are pledging allegiance to ISIS, it's not really allegiance to ISIS so much as it's trying to, you know, gain a lot of notoriety for whatever it is they're doing. Because, you know, if someone shoots someone in the knee, you know, that's not going to make the national news. But if you shoot someone in the knee at the mall and then you say you're doing it for al-Baghdadi, you're going to get national attention, right? And I think people know that, and that's why they do those things. But at the same time, I don't really think there is this kind of internal dialogue about, like, you know, realizing that in many cases, perhaps, you know, the people who are doing things like this are playing the media, because we've used and latched onto these very simple narratives about terrorism and why people commit violence.
Well, Trevor, I'm really very pleased with the work you do. I think you can tell. I've got a great respect for the credibility that you provide in delving into these issues. And I hope you will stay on this beat because, as I said, unfortunately, you appear to be the major franchise holder here. And we're relying on you to keep bringing some transparency and sunlight to these cases that truly need it.
Well, I appreciate that, Peter, and I certainly appreciate you having me on the show several times now. So thanks so much for your time.
Trevor Aronson here on the Peter B. Collins Podcast. Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with journalist Trevor Aronson. Send me your comments, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.